Welcome! You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
It strikes me often when our newspapers or our politicians refer to the so-called third world. And perhaps a bit less a dehumanizing thing, but though sometimes it is, but much more so it's a disconnecting thing. Every time there's a reference to the third world, it's an effort, whether it's conscious or subconscious, to disconnect ourselves from those other parts of the world. And there is no third world. There is no other world. There is just simply this one planet.
That's the voice of Graham Russell. On this week's show, we speak to Graham Russell from Rights Action. We deconstruct the meaning of Graham's new book, Code Z59.5. There is only one people here, so stay tuned.
Someone who has not taken for granted the role that each citizen plays and the kind of responsibility that we all have to create a different society is Graham Russell. Graham Russell is the founder of Rights Actions. He is also the author of Code Set 59.5, a brilliant book titled There Is Only One People Here. We're very privileged to have him on our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Sylvia. Thank you for having me on.
Now, your book, it's a brilliant book in terms of the stories that you reflect. You don't write from the perspective of a researcher who goes and objectifies the people, but rather you are trying to bring forth the voices of the people you are working with as co-authors of this story that we collectively construct. Talk a little bit about your book. Why the title, Code Set 59.5, There's Only One People Here?
I'll get to that in a second. I mean, the book itself is a summary of diary excerpts that I've kept a diary for many years, and through all the years of my work on human rights issues in Mexico and Central America, etc. And whereas on a regular basis I do a lot of other types of writing, articles, urgent actions, reports, on an ongoing basis I always put sort of more emotional and direct reflections into my personal diaries. And then Code Z59.5 is a collection of those diary excerpts. Some of them are personal observations, some of them are direct quotes from people that I've met here and there. Some of them are quotes from things I've read about the issues that I've worked on. So that the book itself is sort of a chronological collection of diary excerpts, anecdotes, and observations. The title comes from just one of those things I read. It was actually a United Nations report. One of the issues we work on, and I've worked on for many years, is the whole issue of poverty. And I think poverty is usually misrepresented and misunderstood in the so-called mainstream media by most politicians, by entities like the United Nations and the Organization of American States. Poverty is usually presented to the reader or the observer as almost something that's very lamentable, but bad luck, almost as a natural occurring state of affairs, as opposed to presenting poverty as an issue of injustice, as opposed to presenting poverty as an issue of violations of human rights. I've long been of the opinion that poverty is the greatest killer on the planet Earth, and that it's fundamentally a result of injustice that occurs inside nations and with the exploitation of the poorer sectors of a certain society, and between nations, as wealthier and richer nations exploit poorer, more dominated nations. So that's my understanding. And so one time I was reading some report by the United Nations that was some sort of catalog of issues that the United Nations work on. And I can't quite remember all of the other ones at the particular moment. But reading through it, there would be a section on how to deal with whooping cough, a section on how to deal with parasites, a section on how to deal with response to disasters. And then it came upon this section called Code Z59.5, and so I read it. And it was a section about poverty. And so it really struck me in the most sort of absurd but sort of harmful fashion that the United Nations had come up with this sort of little category called poverty or extreme poverty as sort of one more little issue that needs to be dealt with, as opposed to extreme poverty being the biggest killer of human beings on the planet year in and year out, and extreme poverty as being a result of human rights violations, as a result of injustice. So it just struck me as how almost absurd but misleading this United Nations categorization was. The other part of the title is, there is only one people here, and that's actually a quote from my son when he was like 3 or 4 years old, and we were walking down the street once, and I was just taking him to the park, I believe, and he said, "Huh, there's only one people here." And I went, "Oh, who's that?" And he went, "Well, there's you, there's Camila, his sister, my daughter, and me, one people." And that's what I actually really believe, is that there's just one people here on the planet. And it's a challenge for all of us to, and the sooner we get to understanding that, that we're just one people on the planet, the sooner we might get to implement and really live by values of cooperation and sharing, as opposed to living by values of competition and domination.
That's beautiful. I wanted to point out that in your book, you write a letter addressed Canada's Governor General, who traveled to the Davis Inlet, a place that she calls attention. She says she decries the third world conditions of poverty, suicide rates, and discrimination. And in your memo, you say, "Dear Governor General, there is no third world. There is only one world. Humans create and distribute wealth and poverty, racism and oppression, joy and sadness in it." And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the way in which this kind of labeling allow us to dehumanize and to distance ourselves from the suffering of others, and permits the continuation of repressive practices, whether it's mining, whether it's exploitation. Can you speak to that?
That, again, is just the type of thing I would write in my diary. In my day-to-day work, I don't work directly on First Nations issues in Canada, but I follow a wide range of issues, and so I was reading the paper at one point, and that would have gotten front page coverage, I presume, in the newspaper of the day. And it just struck me, as it strikes me often, when our newspapers or our politicians refer to the so-called third world, and perhaps a bit less a dehumanizing thing, but though sometimes it is, but much more so, it's a disconnecting thing. Every time there's a reference to the third world, it's an effort, whether it's conscious or subconscious, to disconnect ourselves from those other parts of the world. And there is no third world. There is no other world. There is just simply this one planet. And the so-called third world was a false categorization made up by so-called first world leaders decades ago to distinguish between the rich and the poor. But to distinguish in a way is to pretend that there was no connection. There was no connection between the poverty and injustice of countries in Latin America or Africa with the policies and actions of countries in Europe or North America. And so I'm always sensitive to and very critical of anyone who uses this notion of the third world as if it's some other place over there that we are unconnected to. And then specifically with respect to First Nations issues in Canada, they're usually presented in a way that they're problems that do occur, and they're very heart-moving problems, but they're disconnected with or unconnected to how Canada operates. And along the same lines, but elsewhere in the same book, I just refer to the fact that there is no native problem in Canada. There is no First Nations problem in Canada. These are Canadian problems. The situation of First Nations people across Canada is profoundly a Canadian problem. So in my writing and in the book Code Z59.5, I just endeavor to focus critical attention on that so that we can see the interconnectedness between us all. And sometimes presenting that interconnectedness is not comfortable, referring to your question with respect to mining companies in Latin America. Rights Action today works on a wide range of mining-related struggles in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And most of the companies there are Canadian companies. And so it's one thing for Canadians to care about the poverty of people in Honduras, Guatemala, or El Salvador, and there's just vast amounts of poverty in those countries. But it's quite another thing when you hold the mirror up and say, and look, our mining companies are down there contributing to and benefiting from this poverty. It makes it our problem as well, not just their problem over there.
When we talk about Indigenous problems as a way to distance the overall responsibility of the government, we're also doing something else. In particular here in BC, we are seeing a mass movement by mining companies to occupy Indigenous land and territories where Indigenous people live and have lived for, since time immemorial. But there's this constant move to displace Indigenous population, much like there is a constant move to displace people in Latin America. I wonder if you could talk about the connection between the resource-oriented economy that we now see, whether it's mining, water, gas, and the displacement and aggression by states against Indigenous people.
To be fair, it's not just the aggression of states against Indigenous people. More often than not, it's the aggression of states and or private companies using military and police against usually poor people. Oftentimes they're Indigenous people, but they're not always Indigenous people. And whether it's in Canada or Guatemala or Honduras, this is a historical phenomena, and it's just a very sad and unfortunate one, that we enable and permit economic policies that allow companies to go wherever they want. I'm simplifying a bit, but not much, to get access to mineral resources or energy resources or food resources, the production of fruits and bananas and pineapples and strawberries. We enable and encourage our companies to go and produce something that will sell on the international markets and pay little or no heed, A, to the environmental impact of this endeavor, and B, little or no heed to people that are already living on those lands and that are the true and prior owners of that land. This is a time-worn issue. It's an issue that I've worked on for many years in Central America and Southern Mexico, but Canada has many examples of this type of sort of economic exploitation, abuse of economic exploitation as well.
In your particular work with Rights Action, you focus on the struggles of people in Latin America, particularly Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Why has your focus been predominantly in this region?
Happenstance, really. To give the conclusion first, how I conceive of the work I do is that I'm someone who's an activist for global equality and justice, someone who's an activist for sort of a sane relationship with Mother Earth, with the environment, and that I happen to work in Southern Mexico and Central America, but that I would bring the same approach to these issues if I were working inside the borders of Canada or if I'd happened to get drawn into working on similar issues in South America or Africa. And the happenstance part of it is just my own personal path in life, that in the early 80s I went and lived in Mexico for a year and worked in an orphanage and then got an extraordinary exposure, A, to endemic poverty, widespread systemic poverty, that really sort of shocked me. And B, got really educated about the military regimes in Central America that were carrying out widespread repression, massacres, and genocide against the poor and indigenous people of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, etc. So I just got a personal connection to Central America and southern Mexico. So that's all happenstance. That was my personal path in life. What is not happenstance is that I also came up with the understanding that these were not local or national problems in Guatemala, Honduras, or El Salvador, that these were global problems as well, particularly when one looks closely at the role the United States played in supporting these very brutal military regimes. And so that brings me back to the first point I made, that though I happen to work in Central America and southern Mexico, I believe that these are struggles about global equality, global justice, and that just happens to be the place where I most work.
When I read your book, I'm attracted to particular themes. And one of the things, though, that we don't do very often, or that the media, commercial media, doesn't do, is point to the rich and the role they play in the creation of poverty. In your book, you have a small insert where you said numbers that define us. And you give some examples about how in 1999 there were 2 million millionaires in the U.S. and how in 1999, only 10 years later, there was 8 million millionaires in the U.S. and how the distancing in terms of the kinds of expenditures they make. So why should we, as a society, recognize the distance between the interests of corporations, whether it's Goldcorp or mining operations here in Canada, and the interests of citizens, which seems to be blurred in the news coverage of what economic development should look like?
What I can comment on with respect to the wealth and the poor, the poverty and the rich, whether it's inside countries or between countries, that's a very common theme that comes up over and over in my work, and it comes up over and over in my writings. But the reason I refer to it so often, that I discuss it so often, is because it's so obvious around the world, this extraordinary gap between the haves and the have-nots, the rich and the poor, and yet our understanding of it is so skewered. So in sort of mainstream terms. And so we're very quick to talk about and refer to the underprivileged as if that's what they were. But we never talk about the overprivileged. We're very quick to talk about how it's unfortunate that there's so many poor people. And yet we don't talk about how it's actually unfortunate to have so many rich people. And so this is the complicated part, because the wealth of some is directly or indirectly related to the poverty and the poorness of others. That's a general statement. I don't think that that's true in absolutely every single case, but as a general rule, that is how our global order works economically, both inside borders and between borders. That's a real challenge in our media, in our popular culture. So on the same day that you might have a news report or a politician or a United Nations report lamenting the poverty of the poor in Africa or Central America, they will be standing on a podium with multimillionaire rock stars or movie stars or multi-billionaire so-called philanthropists or entrepreneurs lamenting the poverty of others, but making no direct connection to the fact that certain companies, certain people, certain nations are benefiting in an unjust way from this very unjust economic model. This is the issue that we need to focus a lot more attention on, the critical issue and the links between poverty and wealth.
I think that you're right. In so many ways, it's easier to study the poor and to point fingers to the poor, or like Obama say that the poor has to take responsibilities and black parents have to take care of their kids. But without looking at the structures that prevent black Americans from accessing education, health, you know, within the country, without looking at the structures that prevent children from actually being able to develop cognitively by simply having the appropriate required amounts of food and clean water and air that they need. One of the key roles that I think your work highlights in terms of recognizing the damage the mining operations have caused in Latin America is the connection to food security and the right to land of peoples, whether in Latin America or in Canada or anywhere in the world, and the connection between corporate interests and those who are landless and displaced. Can you talk a little bit about what can we do? Because I think most people feel, the structures are put in place and we have to participate within those structures. How do you see our role?
I would like to comment on this notion of anti-mining, because in a very real sense, I'm not anti-mining at all. I understand that mining is a complicated sort of business, a complicated industrial endeavor environmentally all the time. And so if there is mining, it has to be done in an extremely careful way. But there's a reason why I insist on the fact that I'm not anti-mining, and the work that we do in Rights Action is not anti-mining. And I insist on it in part because this is how we're labeled by the mining companies, by the Canadian government, or once in the Globe and Mail, they refer to us as an anti-mining group. And it's misleading, because the real issue, as you said, is about the harms and violations that are caused by mining, which are often very similar to the harms and violations caused by the construction of hydroelectric dams, or the harms and violations caused by a really exploitative, unjust production of tennis shoes or clothing in these sweatshops in Central America, or the production of bananas, fruits, coffee, etc. What we need to focus on are the harms and violations, not firstly on the particular economic endeavor. And that brings it to the broader issue that you refer to, and it's the development model itself. The mining companies, to take this one example, the mining companies, the Canadian government, the World Bank, investors often, they all sing this song of bringing development to the people of Guatemala, bringing development to the people of Honduras or El Salvador or wherever they're mining. They're always singing the same song. We are bringing development to these people, which is nonsensical. And it sort of begs having a really open and critical debate about what is a good development model and who are the owners of a good development project. So the types of organizations that we work with in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, not only do we support them as they denounce the harms and violations that they're actually living, very serious harms and violations, contaminations that lead to death, or repression that leads to killing people. Not only do we support them in denouncing the very real harms and violations they're living, but we support them as they try and implement a different model of economic development. Because all of these communities, most of them are very poor, they do want development. But they want to be the owners of the economic activity that's being operated in their communities and in their territories. They want it to be usually agriculturally based first, because these are agricultural communities, and they want it to be a type of development that respects the environment, that doesn't clear cut the forests, that doesn't contaminate their rivers, and on and on and on. So just taking the focus on one economic industrial behavior, mining, should open for us this huge debate about what is a healthy and good development model. And if we had that debate and that discussion on an ongoing basis, then the Canadian government would not be promoting the expansion of our mining companies all around the planet. Investors would not be blindly investing their money in mining companies all around the planet. If real community-controlled development was our number one priority, which it should be if we're concerned about the well-being of people across the planet, then mining would not be the first choice of these communities.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. Now, your book is available through Rice Action. How can people get access to it?
They should write me at info@rightsaction.org.
I want to conclude by talking a little bit about your work with Rice Action and the recent delegation to Honduras. If you could just give a brief synopsis of the intent of this delegation and why it's so critical that we continue to focus on Honduras at this time.
I've written a lot about Honduras, both in my diaries and in articles related to our work with Rice Action. And for those that follow Latin America, they would know that there was a military coup in Honduras in June of 2009. And this was a very sad turning back of the clock. Many Latin American activists, people concerned about human dignity and well-being in Latin America, had been sort of hoping that military coups would be a thing of the past. And then in 2004, the Haitian people were victims of a very terrible military coup. And then in 2009, the people of Honduras were again the victims of a very terrible military coup. But with our work with Rights Action, we've been working in Honduras since 1998. So we got very involved in supporting all of these grassroots organizations that we had been working with for many years. They turned their attention and their energy towards resisting the coup regime and sort of bringing together what's fundamentally a pro-democracy movement and fighting for the restoration of their democratic order. And that struggle continues in Honduras because the same military-backed regime is still in power. And they don't show any signs of wanting to give up power democratically to the will of their own people.
Thank you again for being with us. Once again, your website?
The website is rightsaction.org, and my email is info@rightsaction.org.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Sylvie. Bye now.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.